today the university systems have changed to the point where they're requiring everybody to publish whether they should mm-hmm. or not. And
I had professors turn into me projects and sometimes list publications of such ephemeral little old stuff.
That's what I was wondering too, and you're talking about all the thousands of books being generated each year. Mm-hmm. Is there any way of your knowing, because nobody could possibly read all these, the general quality of these? Do you think it's gone down, or do you think they are good scholarly work?
Well, I think the young historians are better researchers than we were. I think they're more diligent. We were diligent, but they have more time. Universities have research funds, and they're not teaching the heavy loads that we taught. And they have better libraries.
You can say the facilities they have, are better.
Better facilities for, take for instance, these copying machines.
Right.
I went over yesterday and took some notes in 10 minutes. It would have taken me 3 hours or more to take. I can just dash them off like that.
Microfilm.
You can bring the world to your desk mm-hmm. in microfilm.
You don't have to travel as much to
that's right.
see documents.
In gathering petticoats and plows, I travel thousands of miles. In gathering material for a Southern Country Editor, I traveled heavens above. I have no knowledge how much I traveled. Or in doing travel series, I traveled a lot in connection with it. And all my other books, the Kentucky River, I traveled an astonishing number of miles in doing it. Now, you could almost do it. I know nothing about computers, but and word processors. Everybody tells me those things are wonderful, but I'm too far gone to get into that. But the facilities are just so much. Imagine a young instructor in 1931 in a university that couldn't pay salaries, in a university that had a library that had almost just nothing, really. Just imagine setting out to be a historian in that kind of a situation.
Even though it's easier today to have material sent to you from anywhere in the world,
sure.
and ostensibly you're able to write a book
yeah.
in your own home without ever leaving it for research, do you think that people who do this maybe lose something from not traveling to this to
force? I want to point out that when I left Washington doing research on my this station, they were just breaking ground for the National Archives.
Oh goodness! So it preceded the archives themselves.
That's right. Research. And only since 1958. And we've been in business with the state archives here in Kentucky.
Right. Do you think it's still important to travel, not maybe to every library or every place that holds a document, but to...
Oh, yeah. If I were a young historian, I'd certainly go to the National Archives and look.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked in the Huntington Library twice, marvelous. The Library of Congress, oh, heavens above. Surely. You never know when you turn the page what's going to turn up on the next page.
Right.
You never know what's going to stimulate an idea.
And also being on site helps you maybe find things that have been cataloged incorrectly on occasion.
That's
isn't
right.
that right?
Well,
coming upon letters and
I'm
documents.
I'm a believer there's nothing like turning that page yourself. Yeah.
In terms of the immediacy
like the
of the history.
Feel of it, smell of it, see.
Right. Can't get that on microfilm or microfiche.
That's right. That's a sort of a hygienic process.
It also gives you headaches, too. What about the, not just the quantity of books being turned out today in history, but, or the quality, but what about the trend in writing style? Not that everybody is writing the same way, but do you have anything to say about that?
I don't think. I have mixed feelings about the quality of writing. Some of these young historians write in a pretty dead, static style. Not many times do you come on a book now that has real literary quality.
Yeah. Why? What do you attribute that to?
To graduate training, graduate seminars. Too many fleas have begotten fleas, and too many professors were trained in the old methods of get the facts, drag them in, and stake them down as best you can.
Do you think there's a fear of adding style to writing, that that would somehow detract from
quite
the scientific that's nature
right.
of the
I'm sure there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Too many graduate seminars, too many stylistics, too many Chicago manuals of style.
And what is it, the last 40 or 50 years when all disciplines have been trying to justify right. their existence according to hard science?
That's right. You take a sociological study. I haven't looked at many of them recently, but they'll spend half a book describing their procedures. And who gives a damn about those things? Just so long as they give you some indication of where all this stuff's coming from.
Right.
But to describe, and clearly if they'd said, now I'm writing for others, other specialists, they go on and on and on describing their procedures.
Well, who on the national or international scene do you think is writing some model history books right now?
I would be a bit hard pressed. The lad who just with his Scotch name, gracious me, Bill. University of Chicago. He's been president of the American Historical Association. Writes, has written very well. I think of his name just a moment. I'm ashamed of myself and I can't recall his name. I know him. Van Woodward writes wonderfully well. Bob Remini, biography, does a very good job indeed. Jack Hexter does a good job. There are Bob. I talked with him. He was at Princeton. Writes well. David Donnell writes well. Why can't I remember the boys? David Preston. McNeil, Bill McNeil is the Chicago one.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to think of. And Bob Palmer, okay. Preston.
And where did you teach with him?
I taught with him at the University of Chicago.
When were you at the University of Chicago?
1947, I believe it was.
Let's see. Was this a one-year visiting?
No, it was a visiting.
Yeah. You also were awarded a Guggenheim, weren't
you? Right.
And that's can you tell
a bit
me about
of an,
that?
That's an embarrassment to me.
Why?
I've never fully delivered on that because the state of Kentucky got in my way on that. Right in the middle of research, Ned Breathitt was governor, and he disrupted that completely in that constitution matter. And that's been a painful matter to me, frankly.
What was it to be?
I still have the notes, and I still am going ahead with it on the Louisville Journal, George Prentice.
I see.
And I fully intend to get that done if time and life hold out for me.
Right. Yeah. What incident or historical occurrence in the past decade or so do you think will emerge as something very significant in the future? I know there are millions of them, but something that you think may not have been covered the way it should have been?
You threw me a curve there in that last statement. We've been pretty thorough in covering. There are a lot of areas that need investigation. I think in the 20th century, we certainly will have a lot of writing. We've had a lot of writing, libraries full of the impact of world wars on the changing of the course of American civilization, of world civilization.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that will be important is the internationalization of history, the writing from the international, the world viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll go on writing in the field of civil rights, looking at really the application of the Bill of Rights of the Constitution, the due processes of law.
Mm-hmm.
I think an area which is a frontier indeed is the urbanization of American society, of world society. Then a big topic, that the two big topics that will figure prominently in the past and in the approach to the future. One is communication, instant communication.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the distribution of world products and in an effort to make sure all the people on this globe somewhere or other have just the basic food to put in their bellies.
Right.
I think those are important things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to ask you about your writing habits. When you are writing, you talked about not using computers. How do you compose? Do you compose longhand or on a typewriter?
I can do it both ways. I can do it both ways. But generally, I have a lap board, and I sit down with that across my lap and write it out, rough it out longhand. Then I take a typewriter and rough it out some more. And then I begin the refining process and the cutting and adding. I go through five or six drafts before I'm satisfied with it.
Is there a certain time of day that you work? Or do you work pretty regularly on one project or on several?
I snatch desperately for 60 years for time. I should be out to have that lap board right now. I write at night a great deal.
And would this be after teaching in the day, or
surely.
Just so you're able to do both things at once?
Fortunately, I'm not temperamental. I take it as it comes, And I can lay something down on my desk and go and teach a class and come back and pick it up.
So you don't have to have uninterrupted time.
If I did, I'd be insane. Yeah.
Or you would have only written one book or something.
That's right. But I have the ability to sit down and stay with it once I get started. I have determination to get it done. Mm-hmm. That's what it takes. Mm-hmm. And I hope, but I sometimes question this, I have pretty good research ability. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when I come on things that I should have known 50 years ago, that's brand new to me, I wonder if I'm just plain stupid.
I doubt it. What advice would you give aspiring writers?
Put his pants on, sit down on them, and stay down on them.
Just write, huh?
Write, sure. Don't wait for a muse to come sit with you because she's all flirting with somebody else.
Right.
Get a topic well formulated in your mind first. Then explore. Explore, explore, explore what the sources are and what aids you might be able to use. And then begin taking those notes. And take those notes. Take notes, notes, notes. Half of them you may throw away, but who knows? There may be one line in there that will mean a whole page to you.
Right.
I just accidentally came on a line the day before yesterday. It gave me an entirely new perspective on this thing I'm doing.
What was that?
That possibly John Bradford was stimulated to do his notes by Jefferson's notes on Virginia. I don't know why. I felt just plain dumb when I read that. I should have thought about that in the beginning. But you never know. One thing leads to another. And I said a while ago, you never know what the next page you turn will reveal to you. And there's a certain excitement of the hunt. I get a thrill out of searching for things.
What are some of the things that you've turned up in research that you hadn't anticipated?
About everything.
Covers it?
Oh, yes. I think you can say that you get new ideas. You get, in reading, you are able to put together the sequence of facts. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you come on a key fact that will reveal an altogether new perspective.
I was wondering if there was anything in particular that was really startling or something that you and
others... I don't think I've ever come on anything that revised, tore down the whole house of history. But I've come on things that completely refuted. For instance, the other day, in reading, I discovered there was a man here in a very early time, about the time that Daniel Boone came into this region, who was wandering through the region with just a slave. And he describes his stepping on a cane and injuring his foot. As a matter of fact, he had to extract a great long sliver of cane from his foot and was crippled. And he was wholly dependent on a slave boy. Well, I think that's the first black in the state. That's an account of that nobody's ever seen before.
Where did you come across this?
In those notes. and this man's description. You'll sometimes come on, and I must say I got a new perspective. I already knew it, but I got it in a factual context of women in on the frontier.
What is the new perspective?
Who they were and when they were here, and how they reacted to all this pressure of Indian attacks, for instance. They demonstrated ounce for ounce the same courage that men had in this. And they added that ingredient of softening the ordeals, really, of the frontier. All the way across, you take those wagon trains going across to California, Oregon. Those women were there. Can you imagine giving birth to a child out on a road? Can you imagine burying a child in a grave that you'd never see again? Can you imagine having to do housekeeping inside of a fort with cows locked up in and hogs and sheep and quarreling children and fear of Indian attacks, and when they came, loading guns and wondering if the next moment you'd be captured and be raped and mistreated? Can you imagine all those things? Yeah. And that was, they step for step were an important part of it. Mm-hmm. And you get new perspectives on that. You get a new concept of the factual information about it.
What haven't we talked about that you think is important to mention about your writing or about your life?
I think, let me turn that one over a little bit.
All right.
I think in writing, sometimes there's a lot of luck in an author's life in getting a publisher, and then dealing with publishers and dealing with editors. I never had a quarrel with a publisher. A lot of authors do.
Yes.
I never had a quarrel with an editor. I always listened to copy editors. They're important. Once you've published a book, you go naked and alone to the world because those reviewers get hold of you. They're competent reviewers and they're incompetent reviewers. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter which they are. If they give you an adverse review, they sting you. Mm-hmm. It makes no difference whether they're competent or incompetent. They are in print.
Right.
You have to learn to take the reviews. And most of the times, the review is not worth a damn anyway. So, there you go. But the fellow who read that review doesn't know that.
Yes.
And I never answered a reviewer. But one time, I had a reviewer that came close to accusing me of plagiarism. And I went after him hard, in a hurry, and he never did respond to my letter. But I certainly went after him about that kind of unethical thing. Mm-hmm. My advice as editor, I was editor of the Journal of Southern History, to an author, don't respond to a reviewer. They are the ones who have the last say. And you can't win in those things. Go ahead and never thank a reviewer, never fuss at a reviewer. Just take it. Going to come. But I remember when my Rampaging Frontier came out, I was very anxious to see what the reviewers would say. I must say I'm anxious every time a book comes out to see what the reviewers will say, how it strikes me. The book, Old Brooklyn Eagle, reviewed the Frontier. And they got Bernard DeVoto to review it. Girl in the library said There's a review of your Rampaging Fruit. Call me in the Brooklyn Eagle. And I asked her who reviewed it, and she said, Bernard DeVoto. And I said, and he could be savage in his reviews. Mm-hmm. And I asked her if it's favorable or not, and she said, well, it's not favorable. And I knew he just ripped me apart. So I went over and read the review. And it was a whale of a good review and a very favorable one. And I came home walking on air. I had one of the nicest reviews I ever got. I think the book was written by Stephen Vincent Benet. A very good review, and I was so happy about that.
Yes.
And I had full-page reviews of several of my books in the New York Times book review section, Chicago Tribune, and I was very pleased. I've had adverse reviews. You can't write without those.
Sure.
You're going to get those things. Just, I no longer react much one way or the other to them. They sting you a little bit, but so what?
Right. Can you talk a little bit about your editorship of the Journal of Southern History?
That was not one of the happiest experiences I had.
I was
just overworked every way. But it was an interesting experience.
What years?
48 to 52. Right at a time when I took over the editorship, you hadn't gotten back in, gained momentum following World War II, and we had almost no articles. And then toward the end you had too many. And you had sometimes a meager flow of books for the review section. And you were scratching all the time. And the articles that you did have required so much editing, so much creative work.
As editor, what was your focus, or what were you trying to do with the magazine?
Trying to produce as good a professional magazine as possible with as sound articles as you could possibly produce. And you don't have much control over the review section. You have simply what the reviewers turn into you there.
Right.
And what books come into you to be assigned.
Uh-huh.
You're pretty well controlled there. But in the articles, you could say yea or nay to the articles. And we did have to say no to many of them because they were just not worthy of publication. They lacked the research, they lacked the writing style, they lacked the interpretation.
Did you enjoy it all being on the editorial end of things instead of the writing end?
Somewhat. I enjoyed the writing end more because there's not much creative about editing. But I sort of had a professional obligation in that case. Because I, first of all, did have professional obligations.
Anything else that we haven't discussed?
Maybe we've discussed too much. I would say, just concluding this, that there's always a yearning in an author's heart that he write a better book. And he doesn't know how to do that, really. Some books come off better than others. I take deep satisfaction in having tried.
Do you?
And take deep satisfaction in having taught. And when I meet old students now, just to have them greet you warmly. You never know how many you might see that want to stomp you in the ground. But those reactions are cheering. And I take deep satisfaction of having had a career as a historian. If I had the choice to make now, I'd make the same choices. I have no regrets in that respect. I wish I'd been a better teacher. I wish I'd been a better author. I wish I could have done more things.
But what you've done is what most people hope to and can't. Do you believe that as a historian, as a writer of history, that you, as a writer, have an author's particular vision that goes through all of your books, or do you believe that because you are writing factual histories that what you might call a writer's vision doesn't come into play?
I don't think a writer's vision really comes into play with a historian. But one thing you mentioned does. Style is like your facial formation or your personality. You have a style, and it's you, and you can't get away from it. You're a slave to it. And sometimes it's a kind slave, sometimes it can be a very unkind one. But you, that's the individuality of an author, is his style. And that goes with you through lifetime, just like your fingerprints. That's there.
So it's your...
And you don't have much control over it one way or the other. But
are you saying
there's involved in being a historian that matter of integrity. Always you should be honest, at least. Even in error, you should be honest.
So maybe you could equate the historian's writing vision as a consistent approach to whatever he or she is writing about, as opposed to trying to put a certain viewpoint or a certain slant on anything written about.
That's right.
Would that be
accurate? I've never been a thesis historian. Mm-hmm. That's what you're saying.
Yes, basically.
No, I've never. I've known historians who pursued a thesis throughout their life.
Uh-huh. And many novelists do, writing the same thing from different perspectives over and over.
I had a dear friend who died here not long ago, built his house next door, wrote two books, or wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book in that house.
Who was this?
Bud Guthrie. Huh. He pursued a theme throughout his whole writing career, the West. Mm-hmm. Bobby Ann Mason pursues a theme.
Yeah.
Robert Penn Warren, in large measure. Right. I think most creative writers do.
Right.
And sometimes they fall on their faces. you know, sometimes I think Margaret, called her, with Gone with the Wind.
Mitchell.
Was a wise woman. One book.
Well.
And it was a book.
Of course she... She wasn't an accident, so maybe she would have had another one.
She might have. Yeah. And she might have fallen flat on her face, too, that second book.
Someone else is coming out with the sequel to that. That's now, right. Another author. So.
Yeah, that'll cause all kind of fury. I've often wondered about creative writers. I've known a lot of creative writers, for instance, in college. I kept up a golf course, and working out there with me is Bill Faulkner, who became a whale of a creative writer. I knew Red Warren, too. I knew him pretty well. I know this little girl, Bobby Ann Mason. I don't know her well, but I know her. I knew Bud Guthrie intimately. And I know James Steele fairly well. Mm-hmm. Jesse Steele I knew.
Mm-hmm.
I've known Eudora Welty. I haven't known her well. Mm-hmm. And I've known other novelists. I didn't really know her. I met her one time, Julia Peterkin. People of that kind. I've often wondered what they go through in writing. Some of them suffer. Mm-hmm. They suffer the mm-hmm. torture of the damned,
right,
trying to unlock their moments.
Right. Yesterday I interviewed Jim Hall, teaches creative writing here at UK,
mm-hmm.
and in discussing the same issue, he was saying that he believes that every writer is pursuing the same, pursuing the truth about themselves or pursuing some sort of understanding, and that the urge to write comes from this need. And therefore, each creative piece, each book, each short story, poem, whatever, is some exploration to come to an understanding of that need. And what I was wondering was, because of course there are historians who don't write and historians who do, and you seem to have the drive to write as well as to pursue history, do you think there is any sort of theme that is that runs through your work that's consistent, or is it the urge to find?
I think in my case it's been more area than theme.
Uh-huh.
Because I've not always followed a consistent theme.
Right.
Now this won't mean much to you. I've written on the frontier, but I've never been a Turnerian. That is the Turner thesis about the frontier. I thought there was a great deal to it, all right, but I've never knelt at that altar. Or I've never been solely a geographical determinist, for instance, or an economic determinist.
So maybe we're back to the issue of style then.
That's right.
You're approaching whatever you write about from a humanistic perspective would be your
that's right.
vision.
My interest has always been in how human beings fitted into the historical process. They are the historical process.
Mm-hmm.
And what pressures, what forces, natural and generated, bore upon them? What political pressures, what natural forces, geographical forces, what circumstantial forces bear upon them, all those things, and how they reacted to those things.
Well, as someone who has studied all periods of history and all types of people, do you believe that there is a human nature?
Surely there's a human nature. Surely. That's human nature. It's basic in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
We have, all of us get hungry, all of us get cold, all of us get hot, all of us respond to clothing, all of us respond to the natural functions of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
We all respond to weather conditions. We all respond to our economic pinches. We all respond to affluence, surely.
I would think that most people in the humanities and most writers would have to feel that way, but there are many academicians now who refute that.
In what way?
Suggesting that that there's no such thing as a human nature because looking at a field like anthropology, for instance, that the people, that it most influences are environmental instead of genetic, and responses to the environment are environmentally induced, etc.
Well, I'm not competent to get into an argument with that, but it sounded like nonsense to me.
That's what I thought.
For instance, there's bound to be something to genetics.
Mm-hmm.
You could take a child completely away from mm-hmm. its parental environment, but you can't take out of its system the genes it has in the system.
As twin studies have proved.
Yeah. and I can take you in a certain environmental condition. I can take you and show you another woman in an entirely different environmental. Yet, basically, you respond to the same impulses she does.
Right.
Or she responds to the same impulses you do.
Right.
I can, you may be a writer. That's using a talent. If you have a talent, but when it comes time to eat something, you're just as hungry as the other fella is.
Right.
When it comes time to get sick, you're just as sick as the other fella is.
Right.
When they put you on an operating table, no matter how talented an author you are, or if you've got an ulcer, they're going to remove it just mm-hmm. the same way they'd remove it from an elephant.
Right.
Or from Joe Sixpack. When it comes to driving down the road, if you run into somebody and hit them, the law's going to deal with you, presumably, just like it would the
right.
other fellow.
Right.
Maybe I'm not making very intelligent comparisons, but basically, when you finally breathe that last breath, you're just as dead as the other fellow is, and then that's going to be your fate.
Right.
And I don't see how you can argue against that.
There may be differences in values, but mm-hmm. but not in communication.
That's right.
Communication itself would be impossible mm-hmm. among people if mm-hmm. if we didn't have
you
something
have
in common
a,
like that.
You may have that intangible thing called the soul, which mm-hmm. is your psychological or your spiritual or your conscious responses to
mm-hmm.
things,
mm-hmm.
and that may differ in personality differences, or personality reactions. But your personality reactions may be governed altogether by your background experiences and your environmental conditions.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right.
I'm not. You're getting me into an area that I have no competence in.
The question may have been off the topic, except it has reminded me of so many people when I comment on human mm-hmm. nature in terms mm-hmm. of writing, who come back and say, "Oh well, you know, there's no such thing as a human nature." That seems to be a contemporary trend in belief and. That's why I wanted to get your point of view on that.
Man has always made some kind of progress.
Right.
Why? Because he's always had some kind of response to his surroundings.
Right.
But he's always had some kind of inspiration.
Right.
Some kind of aspiration. And since I mentioned that, this word progress has enormous implications, philosophical implications that could fill up volumes, really.
Mm-hmm.
Explorers had some kind of inspiration. What's beyond that horizon? Scientists have had aspiration. ministers have preached to congregations endlessly, mm-hmm. billions of times, that matter of aspiration, spiritual aspirations, mm-hmm. and so on. The whole, all civilizations based on it.
Sure.
Authors, poets. Poets, more times than not, have expressed some kind of aspiration. And fundamentally, when you come down to human nature, basically, and I'm thoroughly incompetent to comment on this other than just reaction. Basically, we all have some fundamental elements in our makeup of kindness and responses to other human beings. We all have a basic capability to love, affection, one form or another. We all, conversely, have a great potential for hate. We all have taste, a distaste. But fundamentally, when humanity is challenged, we have a basic kindness, even in the most savage of individuals. I just came on a note within this week where an Indian raid exhibited an element of kindness to his enemy. Well, basically, that's a human trait.